Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Welcome to another episode of Missing Frames. This is the podcast where we watch all the movies we should have seen by this point in our lives. I'm your host, Sean Eastridge. Joining me for the second time ever, Brad Gullickson. Brad, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me. Ooh, a twofer. I'm excited.
This is very exciting. And not only is it exciting to have you back, I realized, so when we did Dirty Harry, and everyone who, if you're listening and you haven't checked that out, go check that out. That was number 30. That was episode number 30 for Missing Frames. And now this is, I've decided, going to be officially number 40, just to keep that trend going.
Yeah, I'm excited. You know, the thing I appreciate about being asked to come back to the podcast is it's a validation that I did okay the first time. Yay, me.
Well, yeah.
Yay.
No, you're fantastic. I'm so
an only child, so I thrive on compliments and reassurance.
Right. And that's why I invented this show. That's why I invented podcasts in general. I am the inventor of the concept of podcasts. And it's really all a matter of making sure that you get that validation that you need. But I think this is going to be great. We were trying to pick a movie, and this time we were going to flip it, because Dirty Harry is one of your favorite movies that I had never seen before, and we decided, why not flip the table and have you watch a movie you've never seen before, one of my favorites, and we were going through the list, and first of all, it was hysterical, because I sent you my list, and you were like, yeah, there are about three movies on here I haven't seen.
I think it was like five.
Five. All right. So we got a whole hand's worth of movies on my list you haven't seen. But the one I decided to go with is My Neighbor Totoro, the classic anime from Hayao Miyazaki, who is one of my all-time favorite filmmakers. And one of the reasons I decided to go with this one is because you mentioned to me you're not a huge Miyazaki fan.
That is correct, sir. I haven't seen much, so, you know, take that into account. But I'm not really a big anime fan in general, and I hate being that way.
What Miyazaki films have you seen? Which ones have worked better for you? Were there ones that maybe you liked more than others? Or is there any anime you have seen that you've enjoyed? Or is it really just a matter of it's just not your style?
Oh, well, I certainly have seen a Miyazaki movie that I liked quite a bit. The Wind Rises, which I understand is atypical of Miyazaki. But I thoroughly enjoyed that film. And I think the first one I saw was Princess Mononoke. I liked it fine. And I think the reason I saw it was because the theatrical run back in the day was the American script was written by Neil Gaiman, or it was adapted
right.
by Neil Gaiman.
You're right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. And so I saw it for that reason, and I liked it. I didn't love it. I've seen it two more times since that initial run, and I've enjoyed it about on the same level.
Gotcha.
And then I've seen Spirited Away, which I just don't like at all.
Which is amazing. Spirited Away is like top 10 favorite movies for me. Like
I
adore. Yeah, you would know, Brad. You would know.
Everybody loves that movie, and every time I tell someone I don't like Spirited Away,
they're like, it's my top 10, Brad.
Yeah, I feel like human trash. this is not a good intro for me. I am sorry, listeners.
No, this is great.
I'm gonna do better.
No, I mean, honestly, that's kind of the concept of Missing Frames. As great as it is to have people on here watching classic movies like Dirty Harry, and in my case, I really enjoyed that movie. It's more fun for me to do that than like an episode that I did with Aaron Prescott, who was we did Point Break together, and I didn't really love that movie. And I enjoy it more when I can like it, but at the same time, I like getting the honest reaction. We know, we've established you're not a huge Miyazaki fan. So either this will go you know, it'll be the standard reaction, or you'll like it and that'll say something about the movie.
Yeah. And you know what? I'm not going to be nice like Aaron. He was far too calm and apologetic about his love of Point Break. That movie's a masterpiece, Sean, and you should have loved it hardcore.
I know. I feel dirty about that.
Yeah,
so
I would have taken
both...
you to task. So if I don't like My Neighbor Totoro, oh boy. Ooh.
We're both feeling equally dirty for completely different reasons.
Yeah, but I feel like if you don't like Miyazaki, certainly in the film Twitter community, you are an outcast. You're wearing the dunce cap. So I don't like to talk about my lackluster response to his films too often. So I'm really putting myself out there, and it feels uncomfortable.
I'm proud of you.
Thank
you. I'm proud of
you,
though. This is great. I mean, this is a big step for you. So, I mean, part of the reason. So you told me, you know, Wind Rises is your favorite. As you mentioned, that's not the normal favorite. It's very grounded. I have a couple people I know who were huge Miyazaki fans who like outright hate that movie. I enjoyed Wind Rises. It's not my favorite, but at this point I'm kind of like so on board the Miyazaki train. Back when it was his last movie, I was like, you know, it's a shame that he didn't do something more like bonkers like he normally does, but you know, he's earned the right to do whatever he wants by this point, and I'll watch it. But I'm totally in the vein of, you know, Princess Mononoke, Spirited Away. Princess Mononoke was the first one I saw. Spirited Away I saw in theaters, and it's funny, those movies kind of grew on me. I saw them when I was younger, saw them one time and kind of was like, yeah, I like that, and then I would watch them again and was just completely blown away, and so they kind of grew on me. My Neighbor Totoro, I don't remember really the first time I saw it. I think there was a period of time when they were releasing new DVD versions, or maybe for the first time on DVD ever they were releasing all of Miyazaki's movies, and I just went out and collected all of them, and I think that may have been the first time I saw it. So it was probably, I want to say, college years. So this is 2008, 2009-ish. I picked Totoro because you haven't seen Castle in the Sky either. And Castle in the Sky is more in the vein of Mononoke and Spirited Away. It's very, you know, story-driven. It's very like, nature, we must preserve. You know, all his movies kind of have this love of nature. Like, you're fighting to preserve nature. Spirited Away, not as strongly as Princess Mononoke, but there is an element of, like, to Miyazaki, nature is sacred, and it's something that plays a prevalent part in all his movies. But you telling me Wind Rises, I was like, you know, My Neighbor Totoro is a similar vibe. Obviously, it's more fantastical, but it is very... It's one of those movies that I feel like people could watch and walk away from it and be like, what just happened? Like, what was the point? What was the point? I don't want to spoil it too much, but it's very, it's driven more by mood and tone than it is by story or characters. And that's part of the magic of it in a way.
Totoro, which is that big cat bear looking thing, correct?
Yes.
So that creature is certainly, from an outsider's perspective, the most recognizable Miyazaki creation. And if you go to conventions or, you know, you stumble into a Barnes & Noble, you'll find a Totoro somewhere.
You're right. And it's the official mascot of Studio Ghibli, I believe. I think that's whenever their logo comes up, it's always Totoro.
And I like the design of that creature. And as somebody who has grown tired of the Pixar aesthetic or the American 3D animation aesthetic, I want to love Miyazaki. I want to love 2D animation again. And hopefully, like, this will rekindle that love affair.
Well, that's what I'm hoping to. I hope this at least, it'll be interesting. Totoro is kind of, even in Miyazaki's work, it's a bit of an outlier. It's not... It has similarities. You can see this is his third feature. Fourth, because he'd done the Loop in the Third, which wasn't really his movie. It was based on a property that existed. Then he did Nausicaa, and then he did Castle in the Sky, and then he did Totoro. So it's like, in some ways, this feels like his most confident effort yet. But it also, it's the most assured thing he'd done up to this point. And I realize I'm kind of talking about this, and you haven't seen it. So this is all stuff that you may or may not get. I feel like I should wait.
I'm nodding my head. I'm nodding.
I appreciate that. I appreciate the nodding. I appreciate the general recognition of my brilliance and knowing that I'm right in the regard of Miyazaki and that you are terribly, terribly wrong and that Point Break is indeed not a great movie.
No, come on. No. Let's not bring Point Break into this conversation. We'll be here for the rest of the night. I know I'm approaching this film with as open a heart as possible. I really do want to understand the world's love affair with Miyazaki. And, like I said, I've seen three movies. I've waded into the waters. I've gone I'm not so sure this is for me. But I want to drink the Kool-Aid.
That's it. And that's at least as long as you're going into it with an open mind, that's all we can ask. And I mean, on that note, I say let's just get going.
All right. I'm nervous.
Now available to own on video cassette.
And we're back. My Neighbor Totoro. You've now seen it, Brad. How do you feel?
I feel pretty good. I liked it.
Awesome. All right. Well, there we go. We can work with that. Okay. I was watching it, and I think I mentioned this in the pre-show, but it's been a while since I've seen this, so the charm was still there for me. But the whole time I was kind of watching it, and I was a little wary because I was like, I don't really know how Brad's going to react to this. So that makes me so happy.
Well, it is such a lovely movie. That's the word that just pops into my head. It's a warm film. It's a empathetic film, and it's one that I would find I would distrust somebody who said they hated My Neighbor Totoro.
It's a hard movie to hate, even though there are, if you hadn't liked it, like if you had come on here and been like, I wasn't a fan because there's not a lot of conflict, not a lot happens, I would have understood somebody's reasoning. But at the same time, I would have been like, that's kind of why I love it so much. It feels so in tune with childhood, just that kind of magic where it's like you can run around outside and you can play and you can discover magical creatures in a forest, like this very innocent time where you could feel safe and you didn't feel like there was anything you needed to worry about. I mean, it's very interesting that this movie, it's a short movie, it's only about an hour and 20 minutes, but for nearly the entire runtime, there's really no overt conflict to it.
Right. And, immediately after watching it, I do what I always do, is I go to Roger Ebert and I look at his reviews. And
that's great, because I have a couple quotes. I definitely have some. Yeah,
I do have a quote. The first line of his review from 1993, where he says, here is a children's film made for the world we should live in rather than the one we occupy. And he talks about exactly what you were saying, how there are no real villains of the piece. There's no antagonism really whatsoever in the movie. There's conflict and there's, personality, but there's not the wicked stepmother or, some evil vulture hiding in the camphor tree,
Right. Their mom, the worst thing that happens is their mom is sick with, I think, tuberculosis. I don't know if they ever actually say, hinted at.
No, they don't. Miyazaki's mom had tuberculosis, spinal tuberculosis. Mm-hmm. And so the idea is that he was basing this world around a similar childhood to his own in post-war Japan.
Yeah, and it's funny, he says he got a lot of letters from lots of fans who were basically like, and this is all people living in Japan, they basically were like, did you base that town off of our town? And he thinks it's so funny because he didn't base it off any specific town, but he said in interviews, he was basically like, I based it off this idea of what I would see as a city boy, like how I would see this kind of idyllic nature-driven kind of environment. He's like, that's kind of my ideal picture. But it, he thought it was so funny that so many people tuned into that, and that for a lot of people, that is a real place that they grew up in, that it connected and resonated so strongly with those people.
Well, he takes so much time in establishing the place. I think, you know, my expectation of the movie is that we would jump right into this Totoro creature and how it affects the lives of the main characters. But really, you know, Totoro does not pop up until like 20, maybe 30 minutes into the movie.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. And I think it's funny because his producer, his working partner at Studio Ghibli, he was the one who originally kind of presented that idea to Miyazaki. He basically said, hey, look, and this is Toshio Suzuki. So he's, you'll see, if you ever watch any interviews with Miyazaki, chances are this guy will pop up. But basically, Miyazaki wanted Totoro to appear in the first scene. And Suzuki was like, you know, I think we should tease the audience a little bit. We shouldn't, like, reveal our hand so early. And Miyazaki's like, what are you talking about? And he's like, well, look at E.T. Like, E.T., the alien doesn't really show up until about halfway through the movie, like, in full form. So Miyazaki was like, all right. And he just took this kind of timeline of what the movie would be. And he just had all these little lines indicating events that would happen in the movie. And right in the middle, he wrote, Totoro appears. So it's funny that... I agree. It he takes his time kind of building it. And I remember the first time I watched this movie, it took me a little bit to really get into the flow of it. I was like, wait a second. So what is this? What am I watching? Did it take you a bit of time to fall into rhythm, or were you more on board right away?
I mean, to be honest, I was on board right away with the two kids to the point where once the not the fantasy element, but once the Totoro creature came in, I was almost a little disappointed.
So you wanted it to just be about them?
Well, because as the family is coming to the country, you know, and forgive me, I'm going to butcher all kinds of names, but the Kuskubis, you know, as the two sisters who are like just bundles of joy.
Yeah,
you know,
I think this is absolutely. I forget just how I think a lot, and I'm sorry to interrupt. I think a lot of the reason this movie works is because of the sincerity of those characters. They feel so genuine, and there are little things. Miyazaki has a way where he finds little quirks and little things that people do, real people do, and he's able to kind of instill his animated characters with that. And you see some really strong examples of that in this movie. And I it's been a while since I've seen Nausicaä or Castle in the Sky, but I feel like this movie, he kind of sat back and was like, I'm just going to kind of let these characters shine, and I'm really going to build this world and build it around these two and making them fully believable. And I think it's great that you bring that up, because I, watching it again, I was really struck by how effective they were as characters.
Well, as the characters, but you know, to your point, the world, right? So as they're moving into this house and, you know, they're playing with the rotten wood porch and, you know, there's the massive tree and when they go into the shed and those soot gremlins go scattering. And then, you know, and then the acorns, right?
Yeah.
And that when they go to the staircase and that one acorn is bouncing step to step to step to step, it was like something out of the George C. Scott ghost story, The Changeling. There is a version of this film that goes right into the horror, that plays into the darkness of these concepts. And that's, I think, what an American audience would crave, right? They want The Grudge.
Exactly.
They want these soot gremlins to build into something nefarious. And there's that one shot where May, the youngest, she sees the crack in the wall, and the animated camera dollies in on the crack, and she puts her finger in, and, you know, I want the Grudge to pull her finger off. but the dust mites, they explode and erupt, and it is a shock. And the only thing to tell you that this is, you know, an animated family fun thing, and these are not diabolical demons, is the score of the film and its reputation. But I loved how the film just takes its time with establishing the supernatural element and how we just have to live with it. And, you know, you're lucky to have seen these things to exactly. interact with these sprites.
Yeah, it's very organic. And I think that's something, I mean, I'm sure it is part of Japanese culture. It seems like it, because I see these kinds of themes in a lot of great Japanese films. And Miyazaki especially is very in tune with nature. Like I said, a lot of his movies deal with nature very heavily. What man's relationship with nature should be, or how we've gotten too far from that, or whatever. But Totoro is very, in a very, you know, Princess Mononoke, if you could knock it for anything, it's a very, like, nature is wonderful and mankind is evil and we must live in harmony and don't burn the forest down. Totoro is just a very conflict-free version of the same message, just living organically, humans living right in the shade of this beautiful forest and this giant tree with these forest spirits. Just the idea that childhood is that magical time where you can still perceive these things and you can still interact with them. And I love that. But you're absolutely right. It unfolds so leisurely in a way that it's I think some people who watch this for the first time are really kind of like waiting for something to happen. And it never really does happen. And not in the way you expect. But it's funny. I think the first 15 minutes or so is just like, all right, let's go around and do the chores. And they're like cleaning the floors, they're getting water, they're folding laundry, you know, it's like, that's the scene. That's what it is.
Right. And you know, at 85 minutes, Miyazaki's not afraid to take his time to absorb the surroundings. I was reminded of comic books, you know, in particular Mike Mignola, where if you're reading a Hellboy book of his, he'll have these panel inserts of a bird whistling or a frog croaking. And you get those inserts throughout this film. And, you know, later on in the movie, when the children are waiting for their dad to come home and he's late, you really feel the lateness. You know, it slows to a standstill, and then it drags out the reappearance of Totoro. You know, by first you hear his footsteps, and then you see his feet come into frame, and then you see his paw come into frame. Miyazaki is playing with time throughout Totoro, and like I said, I that's what I appreciated most about the movie.
Yeah, and it's at a time especially where he said specifically he knew exactly what he knew exactly the kind of movie he wanted to make, and that it was a very purposeful statement, because this movie was released in 1988. So you're talking about kind of the revolution of the action movie with Die Hard. Lethal Weapon had just come out. You know, this is a decade of action. Akira was released in the same year. One of the definitive animes of all time. Very violent, very brutal kind of action movie. And he very purposefully wanted to make a film that was that the opposite of that. He wanted to prove it could be done. And it took him a long time to get it into production, because for obvious reasons, I mean, you read the script, you look at the idea, and they're like, okay, but what happens? And you have Miyazaki saying, oh no, that's it. That's what's going to happen. And the conflict does come in that. But the magic of it is that the conflict is there. It's just not what it's not what we've been trained to expect. Like, when you were a kid, your parent coming home late, that was that was a huge deal. Like, where is my dad? Is he okay? Like, what's going on? You know, the way he plays that moment and he lets it play out and he lets that be a sequence in the film, like a sequence to create suspense. It's like, our dad, where is he? He didn't come home from work and he missed the bus. And then you have that comfort of Totoro kind of being there and the way they kind of interact with each other and engage with each other. But bringing up Roger Ebert again, he had the opportunity to meet Miyazaki at the 2002 Toronto Film Festival. And he talked about gratuitous motion and the way it works in his films. And the way Miyazaki kind of lets moments breathe, like you're saying, you do get an insert shot of just a toad hopping around and croaking, or just like moments where characters will just sit and sigh and nothing will happen. And Miyazaki said there's a word for that in Japanese, and it's called ma, which basically means emptiness, as far as like trying to translate it directly. And he says it's there intentionally. And he clapped his hands a few times, and he basically explained to Ebert, he said, the time in between my clapping is ma. And if you just have nonstop action with no breathing space at all, it's just busyness. And I think he was really trying to express the importance, especially in an era of film that was moving very quickly. Star Wars, Raiders, great movies, but everything was becoming very fast paced. And animation was the same way. He wanted to slow things down and prove that that kind of storytelling could work. I feel like, I mean, I, as everyone already knows, I'm a big Richard Linklater fan, but I feel like if Linklater were to direct an animated film, it would probably be very similar to Totoro.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, and I wish more American films, not just animated, would learn this lesson.
Yeah, it's true. There's a beauty in that. What do you think it is? Do you think it's just American audiences have proven they're not ready for that? Because it feels like we've seen arguments to the contrary.
No, I don't think it's audiences necessarily. I think it's people making the movies or financing the movies. Especially the type of films that bring in mass appeal these days. And I love lots of those movies, but they're, it's spectacle driven, right? And Ma is anti-spectacle,
right?
But then you go see something like First Reformed or Hereditary, and those are movies that understand silence and understand that when the camera stops on a door, the important thing is not necessarily the door, but the time you're spending with the door and how the audience member is given a place to contemplate what has happened before you see that door and what might be coming after you see that door.
And it could be just as engaging, too. You're basically challenging the audience to engage with the film, to not just sit back and enjoy. And those films are great. I'm not knocking those kinds of films because they're some of my favorites. But like you mentioned, First Reformed especially, which I haven't seen Hereditary yet and I desperately want to. But First Reformed has so many moments where I could feel Paul Schrader like saying, come on, come on. Just meet me halfway. We will make this work, and you're gonna enjoy yourself. But there is something rewarding about that kind of filmmaking and that kind of storytelling when you can engage with it and you feel like an active participant in it. And I agree with you. I would love to see more stuff like that, because I think there's also a beauty to everyday life that sometimes you forget about. And movies like My Neighbor Totoro are just a really refreshing reminder of things you forget are important, that are important. Just, you know, family, spending time with your siblings, spending time with people, being outside, enjoying life, and just recognizing the importance of it. You plant the idea that their mom's sick, and your immediate reaction is, oh no, she's gonna die. But then she doesn't die. In fact, there's like a scene where she's like, I'm gonna get better, and that's like completely takes away any of the tension. So it's like,
that was the biggest surprise of the entire film. At the end when she's like, no, it was just a cold. And you're like, what?
Yeah, exactly. This movie is constantly doing that. But it's interesting how audiences, because films are so driven by conflict and negative things happening, you know, it's one thing happening after another to create an obstacle for the characters, because that's good storytelling. But at the same time, it trains you almost to expect the worst in a way. And a movie like Totoro reminds you that you can expect the best. And that's a great thing as well.
What's so awesome about that moment at the end of the film when Mom says, I don't know why the doctor sent you that telegram, it was just a cold, is it reinforces life as a child, right? As you were saying about Dad being late to the bus stop, as a kid, a telegram from the hospital is such a huge question mark. And then that question mark can develop into a full-blown nightmare. Yeah. And you see that for both of these kids. And you know, when May leaves, she runs off, and then that sandal appears in the lake.
Right.
You know, that sandal is, again, it's like that telegram. Oh my God, the world is ending. May is dead. And as an American audience member, and I think he was doing this, you know, for the Japanese audience as well, he is offering you the terror of a child so that you are right there with those kids on the hunt for the sister, so that when you get to you know, the relief when the cat bus shows up and saves the day, you feel the relief and the joy of that moment even more. And you feel it from the kid's perspective, not from dad's perspective.
Yeah, you feel that innocence. And I also love the way the dad encourages their imagination. A lot of these films are basically like, I saw a forest spirit, and the parents are like, oh, you've been reading too many stories. You're a little nutty. I love the way the dad's like, let's go explore, and let's like, yeah, this is a great tree. It's watching over us. Let's thank this tree. It's a very, again, no conflict. It's everything is working out, and everything's kind of harmonizing in a beautiful way. But
Granny saying, you know, oh, aren't you lucky to have been blessed with seeing these beings?
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of that happening, but it's funny you mentioned the cat bus. I was going to ask you, was there, as far as the creatures go, obviously there's Totoro, there are the soot gremlins, there's the cat bus. How did you feel about the creatures, the magic of it, those kinds of the scenes where the characters would interact with them? Did you have a favorite?
Well, I'm going to put cat bus to the side for now.
Sure.
Like I said before, the soot gremlins I find terrifying. like they genuinely give me the willies.
Well, and I love the idea of like, because they plant the idea of you open a door and you see them for a split second, but then they're gone. I love that because it's basically, even as an adult, I can see myself walking into an empty dark room and picturing that and just the suspense of that.
Yeah, and it's the sound effect, that one sound effect of them scurrying.
Right. But for the most part, I mean, they're also, like she says, they're going to watch, you know, they just want to make sure you're good people. And then very quickly, you know, during the bath scene when it's like, oh, we're a happy family, we're living together, the soot monsters are like, great. Or the gremlins, they leave and they're like, everything's fine. We'll go off to the forest and everything's okay. So even those creepy beings are not horrible.
Right. And then if we're going to move on to the Totoros, I guess there's what, three of them. There's the tiny little white bunny one that turns invisible sometimes. And then there's like the medium sized one. And then there's the one we all know and love iconically, the big Totoro. And as I said before, I had actually seen the movie, I love the design of Totoro. You know, he's not quite a bear, not quite a rabbit. He's a wholly unique design. The massive jaw and the big belly and the eyes and the ears. And then you throw an umbrella into his hand and he's, you know, like the anime equivalent of Mary Poppins. I mean, he's really, really delightful. And you miss him when he's not on screen. So while I was a little disappointed when May finally found him and it became, it's not like it became another story, but it moved into
Overtly. Yeah, it's more overtly like, yes, there is a magic creature that lives in the forest.
Right. But then, you know, she falls asleep on him. And she wakes up, she's found by her sister and dad, and you know, the tree is gone and Totoro's missing, and she's desperate for people to meet him and believe her. And like you were saying, you know, it's not like they say, oh, you know, quit lying. It's not that American moment of, the mummy is not
crazy
in your closet.
Yeah.
they believe her, they placate her. But she needs her family to meet Totoro, or at least she needs her sister to meet Totoro.
Right. And her sister wants to. Her sister's jealous. Like, she's like, I want to meet Totoro. That's not fair.
Yeah. And so, like, I love everything with him. And then, you know, that whole dance number where they ceremonially bring the tree forth from the garden.
Right.
That's a fantastic sequence.
I love that. That's one of my favorites in the movie. It's just a beautiful scene. And I just, like I said, there's a very beautiful message in here about the way humans and technology or, you know, whatever can coexist.
Well, it's all about respect, right?
Yeah.
And appreciation and empathy. You know, going back to the bus stop sequence, the fact that she loans him an umbrella You know, he is very thankful for that. And,
right.
You know, it's a loving moment that, you know, yeah, he'll repay later.
He gives her the acorns and mm-hmm. they are able to plant that tree. So it's, yeah, it's a beautiful way they kind of work together and help each other. And then, yeah, exactly. It comes back at the end when, what's her name? What's the older sister's name? Satsuki?
Satsuki, yes.
Yeah. She, you know, needs his help and he comes to help her. But so the two sisters, you knew they're played by Dakota and Elle Fanning.
Oh, I don't do the dubbings.
You don't? Okay.
No, I only do the original
Japanese versions.
Although found out that the version I watched is not the original script. It, you know, I bought the Disney Blu-ray, and if you go on Amazon, you can look at all these one-star reviews of this disc I have, because apparently they went and they changed several cultural definitions. And in fact, like, the way I call them soot gremlins, I think are in the original script that translated to soot sprites.
Okay.
Although I like soot gremlins better.
I like soot gremlins. Yeah, it's funny. That also doesn't feel like a valid complaint to me. I would understand if it was undercutting the film itself, like, you know,
well,
when you're
these one-star Amazon reviewers, they certainly felt like it was a betrayal to the original translation. And
sure.
I can't say if that's true or not, because I have not read the original translation.
Right. Well, it's funny. A lot of Miyazaki's movies, I'm very similar to you, and I like to watch original dubs, especially live action. But bringing up Ebert again, I know Ebert has always kind of been like, why do people get so upset about English dubs for animated films? Because they're already dubbed in the first place, so it's not that much of a difference.
From my own personal taste, I find that sometimes, not always, the English actor doesn't quite hit the emotional resonance of the line of dialogue, or they misinterpret it. I certainly feel that way about, you know, live action dubbing. Although Bruce Lee, Hong Kong Kung Fu movies, there's something to be said about dubbing adding to the effect.
Yeah, there is. It does add a whole layer of enjoy. Godzilla movies, like it's almost part of the experience. I will say this though: if you ever go back and watch Totoro again, the most recent American dubbing, which is the one I watched with Dakota Fanning and Elle Fanning playing the sisters, is so wonderful, and they are so good. Hmm. And it's just funny because Elle Fanning is kind of taking off right now, and I totally forgot that they were together in this movie, and they're really, really great. I love their chemistry. And then Tim Daly, who played Superman in the animated series, plays their dad. So that's even, it's like, oh, great. The whole happy family.
Huh. That is kind of cute that they would have the Fanning sisters.
And it works very well. I'm like I said, but, I'm like, very similar to you, and it bothers me.
But the problem I have with it, though, is, I mean, it is specifically Japan. And
it's
so
true.
When you hear American voices coming out of Japanese characters in a Japanese setting, I find that off-putting.
I can't blame you. It's definitely something I fully understand. And so you mentioned kind of the music and everything. How did you feel about the score?
It's not like I hate the score, but I do feel like the score is maybe too happy too soon. Mm. And I you know, I'm really harping on this haunted house segment, but I visually, I just loved the unease that I had watching it, and the juxtaposition to the very joyous score that is occurring, the very playful score that is occurring. I didn't like it in that first sequence, but that's probably a cultural thing. It's, you know, again, the Grudge movies. Yep. You know.
And I think Miyazaki was trying very hard to basically make you fight that instinct.
Cause
he said there are a lot of moments where so when May is lost and she's on her own, she's sitting by these statues, and I can't remember exactly what the statues are, but Miyazaki said, you know, it's basically the god of like comfort that watches over children and keeps them safe. So he was very subtly trying to plant the idea that May's okay, everything's fine, she's safe. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, everything in this movie, any slightly sinister thing is undercut with Miyazaki saying it's okay. This is not that kind of movie. You're fine.
I will say that when I started my Blu-ray, it was originally on the English dubbing, and the song that plays over the title credits for the English dub is like aggressively cute.
Yes.
And I had I immediately changed it before the first verse could even finish to the Japanese version of that song. And the Japanese version of that song is also still very light.
It's the same song. I don't even know if it's the direct I think it's pretty close to a direct translation, but it's the same song just, but just in Japanese.
Right. And but so much more palatable, in my opinion.
Right, because here, again, it's all in the translation. And hearing, I think the lyric of the song is, it's, hey, let's go.
Yeah.
Hey, let's go. I'm happy as can be. So that's the first line of the song. It's very like, you're about to watch a kid's movie, and and we're making sure you know. But with Japanese, there's something, because we don't fully understand it, because of the way it sounds, there's almost that disconnect where you can kind of absorb it a little bit
more. Right, right.
But it's definitely something when I watch the beginning, it's like, oh yeah, this is very like, it's not trying to pretend it's anything other than a kid's movie.
It was going to give me cavities. It was so damn sweet.
So was there anything in terms of like a particular scene or moment that really stood out to you that you really loved, that you were kind of like, okay, I'm okay with this movie. I like this movie. I'm enjoying it, or something.
Well, my favorite scene in the film is the opening where they're introducing themselves to the house. And then my second favorite scene is Totoro coming to the bus stop. But you know, like my third favorite scene is Totoro calling the cat bus at the end of the film. And you know, we didn't talk about the cat bus, but like my first note, referring to that creature, is cat bus !! Gross !! just my initial reaction was just like, oh, that is so disgusting.
Is it just you're not a cat fan, or was it just weird?
Weird. I love cats. But like when the cat bus shows up the first time and Totoro boards it, and there's that sound effect of like, wow.
Yeah.
And the door stretches just gives that just icky. And then at the end, when she's finally allowed to board the cat bus, she steps on the floor, which I guess is his back, and it's like squishy.
Yeah.
And it just gives me like strange feelings in my stomach.
That's amazing.
But I love those strange feelings, and I would really like a cat bus plushie of some kind.
Oh, they exist.
Millipede legs.
Yeah, I know they exist. Somebody out there in the world of the internet, get Brad a cat bus.
Yeah, please mail me plush. A cat bus.
It's the dream. But so you know, this movie, you enjoyed it. Was there anything that didn't work for you necessarily? I know we talked a little bit about you wanting it to go into the horror realm, but aside from that, is there anything else that you were like, I don't know how I feel about it?
I mean, no. I really don't think I can say anything negative about the film. And like I said, I wouldn't trust anybody who did. And I would guess that a person who disliked this movie is a very cynical, cold-hearted, awful human being with no joy in their life, and they need to seek a doctor immediately. But like, I think my least favorite thing about it is the score, and you know, it's fine.
Oh man, I love Joe Hisaishi. I mean, sorry. I don't think this is his best score, but I do love the Totoro theme, and I love the theme whenever it kind of is delving into the realm of fantasy. The more kind of upbeat stuff, I'm a little like, oh, this is fun. But I like it when it gets more like somber and thoughtful and kind of, is esoteric the right word? Kind of mystical in a way. I love that kind of it.
You've lived with this film a lot longer than I have. I literally watched it this afternoon before recording. So as we're talking about it, I am really starting to formulate my thoughts. And afterwards, I really enjoyed doing a little research. I watched all the documentary features on the Blu-ray. I read a few reviews. I read some of those Amazon one-star reviews, went through some of the trivia, and I liked that experience. And, you know, I appreciate even amongst the Miyazaki films that I've seen, how different this movie is to those.
Yeah, it really does kind of, in a lot of ways, in its genre, in Miyazaki's filmography, I don't think he made another film that was quite like this. There, he kind of, Kiki's Delivery Service, which I think was the one that followed this, is a similar kind of carefree vibe where there isn't necessarily a driving storyline, but it doesn't quite hit on the magic in the same way for me. I don't think, it's almost a perfect encapsulation, I think, of what he was trying to do in his whole career. And I think, you know, like I, you know, if I were to rank these movies, I think Spirited Away, Princess Mononoke, they'd be at the top of my list. But I'm inclined to put Totoro next just for the sheer gall of the fact that, like, he took a risk to make an animated film that was so absorbed by the silence, by the ma, like we're saying. Mm-hmm. Like, he wanted to make that, he wanted to make that special to prove you didn't have to have gratuitous action or insanity, and that you, if you respected a kid, if you respected a child and you gave them the opportunity to just kind of breathe a little bit in this world, that they would accept it. And it's sad because the movie, when it first came out, I mean, it's not really sad. I mean, the film is a beloved classic now, but when it first came out, it was the lowest grossing opening weekend of all of Studio Ghibli's films. Yeah, it did not do well. And he said, what's astonishing to me is Miyazaki said the studio knew that going into it. They kind of had a feeling. They were like, yeah, we don't expect it to do well, but you know what? We'll let you make it anyway. So they did it. It didn't do great. But then what happened was it had a second life on television, and they had a little thing where they're like, if you send us a postcard and we'll send you a Totoro plush. And I can't remember what the exact number is, but it was basically, I think, 5 3-ton trucks of postcards that they shipped in. And that's when they realized, like, oh, and about 2 years later, thanks to all that marketing material, thanks to all those plushes, they were able to finally break even.
Well, you know, one of my hopes watching the film before I pressed play was that I was going to like it enough to justify purchasing some form of Totoro, whether that's a plushie or a vinyl figure, to go next to, you know, my Porgs and my lying cat from Saga. Like,
right.
I feel comfortable doing that now. You know, the next time I walk into Barnes & Noble, yeah, I'm going to get a Totoro.
That makes me happy because I feel like that's going into this experience and hoping you would enjoy it. I feel like that was the best possible outcome. For, well,
and that's
the all
most
I would ask.
American response.
I'm going to buy something.
Have. I'm going to consume this thing.
Exactly. So, yeah, it like I said, it's not my favorite, but there's something so magical about it. Every time I go back to it, I'm so just enraptured by it, and it makes me want to watch all of Miyazaki's movies. And I'm wondering, do you feel like this might be an entry point to re-enter those worlds, to try again, to maybe go a little bit further into Miyazaki's filmography than you have before?
Yes, I think I would like some curation from you. You know, sure. Whether that's, okay, Brad, you've now seen these 4 Miyazaki movies. Now it's time for Nausicaa or Porco Rosso. And you knowing specifically that I really liked The Wind Rises and I liked Totoro.
Yeah, I think Porco Rosso is that's probably the one I'd recommend next. Very similar to Wind Rises, just because it deals with aviation and planes. And it's funny, the little boy in this movie is always flying planes around, and I have a feeling Miyazaki may have based that character off him. I love the little kind of relationship he has with the older sister, that kind of like rivalry, and then they end up becoming friends. Again, everybody is happy. Everyone's a friend in this movie. But yeah, if I were to recommend anything next, it would be Porco Rosso. But that's great. I think that's awesome.
All right, so I'll definitely do that.
Excellent. And then I guess, man, what should our rating scale be?
Before we move to the rating, I had in my research, I came across like this conspiracy list, like the 13 biggest conspiracies associated with Studio Ghibli films. And one of them was about My Neighbor Totoro. And let me know if you've heard this or not. But
okay, please, yeah.
That Totoro is a symbol for the god of death.
I haven't heard this. And, no, please go on.
Apparently, it's their this conspiracy theory, which you can read on Screen Rant, which is a competitive website of mine. I normally wouldn't point you to Screen Rant, but, you know, there you go. Screen Rant says that the film, or at least these conspiracy theorists believe that the film is based off of or in response to the Sayama incident, which was the rape and murder of a Japanese schoolgirl in the 1960s.
Oh, no.
And how her devastated older sister later killed herself. And so they posit. And
I don't mean that's terrible for me to laugh. I'm laughing because it's so absurd that they're trying to tie this into Totoro, but continue.
The frickin' internet, man. And I'm not going to go into like every little detail here, but I'll just read a little bit of from the Screen Rant article. But, you know, May, which is a reference to the name May, the month of May, and apparently that's when the murder took place.
Okay.
And that when the cat bus comes up at the end, one of the destinations that pops up on the little sign above the cat bus's head is translates to the word grave road, as in like a cemetery road.
Okay.
And that they postulate that at the end, May is murdered, and that is her sandal, and she's dead in the lake, and that she goes looking for the sister, enters the land of the dead, which is where Totoro reigns, and dies herself, and then the two of them are reunited in the afterlife.
That's underworld, I mean, first. Yeah. Yes. First of all, that's amazing that someone connected those dots. If you've not seen I could see somebody who hasn't seen this movie saying, oh, that's interesting. If you've seen this movie, there is absolutely nothing that supports the idea that there's anything sinister going on.
I think the person who came up with this theory is one of those soulless, dead-hearted individuals I was talking about before.
They have to be. Because, I mean, we've just spent the past, like, 45 minutes talking about how this movie goes out of its way to reassure the audience that nothing bad is going to happen to anybody. And it's very clear that this is definitely a world where there are consequences, but everything works out okay, and the girls end up with their mom at the end. You know, it's people, come on.
Oh,
I get theorizing, but like, Totoro is not the movie we want to try to find some hidden meaning about how it's about death. That's absurd.
Yeah.
But I'm so happy you found this. That you shared it with me. And then, so one last random fact that I thought was kind of fun as I was kind of researching and trying to find random things. So Time Out had a compiled list of the greatest animated films made by a certain filmmaker. He ranked My Neighbor Totoro as number one. Oh. And that filmmaker was Terry Gilliam.
Yeah, that's it. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you think I read that, I was like, huh.
Yeah.
No, yeah. That's yeah. I see that.
What's his number two, do you know?
No, man. Damn. Now I want to know.
Well, listeners can jump on that list after they wrap up here.
After they're done with the tweet us the answer. Find me at Yay Sean Dorman and tweet at Brad. Brad, what's yours?
At Mouth Dork.
Perfect. That's our Twitter plug as well. We combined them in a beautiful organic moment, which I guess is less organic now that I called it out. But all right. So final ratings. What do we want to make our rating system? Do we want to make it forest spirits or
I feel like you got to go Totoro's since there's like multiple Totoro's.
Let's do Totoro's. There are multiple Totoro's. So how many Totoro's would you give this on a scale of 1 to 5 with 5 being the highest?
Okay. So I'm giving it 3 Totoro's.
Okay.
Which means I liked it, people. I had a little exchange online before we hit recording with Aaron, who, again,
Aaron
we
Prescott.
Established, you know, loves he's, Point Break.
Yes, he has been on the show.
So, and I'm immediately, if we do this again, I will not rate the film on Letterboxd until the episode is out. Because I put 3 right. stars on Letterboxd, and Aaron, like within minutes of me rating it, jumps to Twitter and begins attacking me. He tags you, and then all these other Twitter followers start jumping on my
jumping
back.
Jumping down your throat. Yeah, they. I think they're expecting this episode to be a bloodbath. And not unlike the film itself, I'm sorry to disappoint you, what you may have expected will not happen, and Brad and I are very happy.
Well, the thing
I think, like, three is fine. I mean,
no,
I'll
three
take
is better
three
than fine. Three is good.
Three is good. And three, when I say three is fine, I mean three is fine. I did not know what you were going to think. I had a feeling you would enjoy this. I was hoping you would. But again, like I said, I think Spirited Away and Princess Mononoke are masterpieces, and you've made it clear you do not. So I will take three. I think that is as good a reaction. And plus, there are three Totoros in the movie, like we were saying.
Perfect.
It lines up perfectly.
Yes. And, you know, this could be one of those movies. I now own it on Blu-ray. As I watch it through the rest of my life, because Blu-rays are going to never go away. They're not disappearing. We all know that. As I continue to watch it, it could grow. And frankly, just talking about it makes me like the film even more. But at the same time, you know, unlike you, it's not a part of my being.
Sure.
The way something like Dirty Harry is.
By the way, check out that episode. Number 30. It's easy to remember. This is number 40. That's number 30.
Yeah, so you're going to have to get me back on episode 50.
Boom. That's right. We're going to get you back. We're going to make it happen. But I, you know what's funny? You know, I do love this movie. I would give it a 4 out of 5. I don't think it's... I adore the film. I love it. But I do knock a star off partially because I do think there is an element of... It's weird that I've spent so much time praising this, but I think the kind of leisurely pacing of it is almost... I don't know if it... I wouldn't say it takes away from it, but it just holds it back from being
interesting.
Yes, I love this so much.
We spent so much time talking about the bonuses of leisurely pace,
That's
Sean.
What's so weird about it, Brad. I don't understand it. And
you
in fact,
just want
maybe...
diehard machine guns.
It's true. I want it to be more like Akira. That's the problem. No, I think... But I also, I want to like emphasize as well, you know, I've been praising it and I love it, but you know, it's not necessarily just perfect 5 stars for me. I don't know. Maybe it is. I mean, watching it, the movie gives me everything I want from the experience of the movie. So.
As I get older, I'm much more free with my 5-star ratings. And the way I came to that was, Brad, you're in the director's chair. You can change a frame, would you? And if the answer is yes, then it's not a 5-star movie. If the answer is no, then it's a 5-star film.
Well, with that logic, I'd give it 5 stars then. Because, like, thinking about it, talking about it, there's nothing I would change about it. Like, I adore every minute of it. And I even the kind of the slower kind of thoughtful pacing that I'm like, oh, well, it doesn't necessarily compel. I find that compelling in and of itself. So maybe I'll just bump it up to 5.
You're
it's
welcome.
A historic moment here. Thank you. Look at the magic. Brad is bringing Miyazaki magic to the episode. You never thought that would happen, ladies and gentlemen, but it happened. It's happening right now. But Brad, this has been fantastic.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
And you also have some really fantastic podcasts that you're on. Why
yes.
don't you tell the good people at home what they are and where people can find them.
You can find me on the In the Mouth of Dorkness podcast, and you can find it on Twitter and Facebook at ItModcast. We talk all things movies, comic books, nerdy things. We interview lots of rad filmmakers, so jump on board over there. Plus, that jerk Aaron and I, we have a podcast together called Rest in Pictures, and every episode, we celebrate the life of somebody who has passed. We just did an episode on Margot Kidder, and we've got an episode coming up on the great Jim Kelly. And final plug, don't go to Screen Rant. Jump on over to Film School Rejects. Find me there every day writing about various news things. And yeah.
And I encourage that as well because it's fantastic. It's great. I thoroughly enjoy reading your stuff.
Thank you.
And I'm not just saying that.
Even if you were, I appreciate it.
And then, of course, the Nerd Party. You can go on the Nerd Party, find all the great stuff we're doing here. You can go on Twitter, at Join Nerd Party, and on Facebook, The Nerd Party. And I believe it's just The Nerd Party on Instagram as well. But that's that. That's My Neighbor Totoro in a nutshell, or should I say in an acorn.